My name's Sean, and I'm an alcoholic. And that's the end of the facts. All the rest of this stuff is my opinion, and I'm not a spokesman for Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not an expert on alcoholism, but I got opinions. Thank you for asking me to be here, Denise. I was last here in 1986. Obviously, the people who invited me the first time are all dead, so they invited me back. I love this conference. I've been talking about this conference since 1986. Everywhere I go, I talk about the hospitality rooms around the pool and the energy in this conference and the fellowship. The fellowship is extraordinary here. It's the best. It's just the best. Thank you. It's been inspirational for me as I've been sitting out there watching and listening to the speakers. I kind of, in my mind, have kind of created a documentary series called The Evil Lives On, The Search for Dr. Bob's Barber. My home group is in Vancouver, British Columbia. It's a Thursday night meeting called Happy Destiny. It's at Burrardon, Georgia, in the basement of the church, right downtown. So if you're ever in Vancouver on a Thursday night, come. And it's a great meeting. I have a commitment there. I fold up the chairs and empty the coffee pots. That's what they let me do. I've been real busy lately. You know, life gets like full of life, you know, and I've been doing some stuff in the theater, and so I haven't been able to get to my meetings, my regular meetings, my evening meetings. So I've been going to like daytime meetings, and daytime meetings when you've been around as long as I have, I get impatient, you know. I just get impatient, you know. Get on with it. And so I've been having a little trouble getting back. You know, when you've been around a while, you know, I'm fighting becoming a bleeding deacon, and I'm losing. So I got back to my meeting, and we got a guy in our group. He's Spanish. He's from somewhere, you know. Spanish somewhere, and like English must be like his fourth language, and. And so they asked him to read chapter 5 last Thursday night. And it was a long haul. It was a long haul. And I love us. I mean, I love who we are. Because nobody said a peep. We just were in there with him, you know? And and I mean, when he got to anonymity, I mean, forget it, you know. And it took a long, long time. And finally we got to, you know, the ABCs. And he said, that we were alcoholic and that our lives had become unmanageable. No shit. I went, yeah. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. But you have to know something. I love to drink. I mean, that's why I'm here. I loved it. I love getting bombed, blasted, wrecked, ripped, knocked crazy, destroyed. You know, all those wonderful adjectives we got for it. I just loved it. I love, you know, fine single malt and great wines and cheap vodka and wine in boxes. And I love stupid drinks in coconut shells with umbrellas. I mean, I loved it. I just love getting it bombed. Just. I come from a large Irish Catholic family. Yeah. Yeah, it's true. It is true. If it weren't for the Irish Catholics, you know, AA would be meeting in a phone booth in Akron. Yeah. We Irish have a fear of evaporation. That's our problem. If you ask a fish, you know about water, it's simply the element that they live in. They probably can't describe it. It's like alcoholism in an Irish family. It's just the element we live in. Ryan Murphy, who happens to have the map of Ireland stamped on his face, he and I were talking that he and I had the failing. There's always people in the family who had the failing. I started on my journey when I was 14 years old. That was the first time I got drunk. I don't remember my first drink because I would go around the parties and sip and do all that kind of stuff. But the first time I absolutely got blasted was 14, and I blacked out and threw up and came to under a bush somewhere and could hardly wait to do it again. Just loved it. And I did it whenever I could. By the time I was 18 years old, I was drinking very heavily. But when I was 17, I started doing drugs, and by the time I was 18, I said the phrase that only an alcoholic says, and you Al-Anons have probably never said this. If you've ever heard anybody say it, you're listening to a drunk. If you've ever said it, you're a drunk. And the phrase is, I can control my drinking. Social drinkers never deal with that concept. I mean, if they do something stupid whilst drinking, they stop drinking. Isn't that weird? So I started with the great obsession of every abnormal drinker when I was 18 years old to control and enjoy my drinking. And I don't know about you, but I never got control and enjoy in the same room at the same time ever. Because when I was controlling my drinking, I was miserable. You know, the only way I've liked to drink was just wildly out of control. I'm a 3 o'clock in the morning, stark naked, howling at the moon kind of drunk. You know, just. Yeah. I was noisy, too. Noisy. A couple of years ago, at our group, we had a discussion on social drinking. Nobody knew what the hell they were talking about. It was really funny. But we decided that social drinking is you have drinks and you don't end up tattooed. Or writing bad checks, or married to somebody you've never met before, or in jail, or or running naked down the main street of town. So we decided that social drinking must be a real drag. So by the time I was 20 years old, I was a daily drinker. By the time I was 24, I was drinking a quart of scotch a day, and I'd picked up a little non-habit-forming marijuana habit. And and I was working the docks, not the ones where the ships come in, the doctors. I love doctors. I think buying drugs in alleys is really stupid. I got a physician's desk registry book, and I memorized symptoms for illnesses, and I would go and tell all three of my doctors what was wrong with me. And I found out that doctors don't know how to say goodbye unless they write something. And if you give them the right information, they'll write what you want. So I lived in the wonderful world of chemistry for a long time. And but I started realizing that something was out of whack. I was appearing nightly on Broadway. I'd done several Broadway shows. I was roaring around in limousines. I was going to all the right parties. I was living the life of Riley in New York, and I'd been born in a small town in Western Canada, and how I got there is a whole other story. But anyway, there I was, and but bombed out of my mind, and so I decided to start going to moral superiors. You've done that probably. You know, you go to the doctors and the priests and the psychiatrists and the psychoanalysts and the groups. And the gurus and the spiritualists and the policemen and judges and lawyers and some of them were extremely learned people, you know, who knew a lot about us. And what they did was they pointed at me and said, "This is what you should do about your problem." Well, so he points a finger at me, I bite it off at the knuckle, and nothing got any better, and. Then I decided what I needed was a good woman, and I met her in an elevator. And we started our dance of death, and we ended up tangoing into AA and Al-Anon. I did a national tour of a Broadway show that took us to California, and it closed in California, so I decided it was a new beginning. I am up to my ass in new beginnings. I don't know about you. God save me from another new beginning. Yeah, I can't take another one. So we got married and she settled down. And now, I didn't marry a teetotaler. She was a 10 martini what the hell girl. I mean, we had a lot of fun. And then one day she just had a sip of whatever she was drinking, put it down, said, "This is boring," and never drank again. And then she noticed that I drank. A lot. And so then it really got nuts, you know. And finally, I decided that hard booze was the problem, so I became a wine connoisseur. That's a wino with a checkbook. I have guzzled some of the finest French wines ever made. I am a consumer. I am not a sipper. I am not a savorer, you know? I drink. Brian and I were talking about eating, you know? You sit down, you shut up, you eat. You know? You unscrew the cap on a bottle of wine, and you throw it away. So I... But about a month before April, I kind of went off the wine and went on to cheap vodka was what I went on to, and I just did a run, about a month-long run. And I don't know, I couldn't handle another Easter, I guess. All that hiding and dying, you know. That was just the eggs. So I ended up getting busted by the West Hollywood Police Department and taken down and fingerprinted and photographed and released on my own recognizance with the front of my pants from the waistband to the knees soaked in my own urine. And that got my attention. And I went home, and luckily she wasn't home. She was off saving somebody who didn't need to be saved. And I was left alone, and I had that moment of clarity, that thing that happens to all of us, you know, and it's a thing when the clouds part, when everything opens, and I saw very clearly the connection between my drinking and my bad behavior. I saw very clearly that I didn't get into trouble when I wasn't drunk. What a revelation. Luckily, something in me said, I got to do something about that, because what can happen with that moment is the clouds can come back, you know, and sometimes they never clear again, you know. I am one of those people, because of my personality, which is bizarre, I believe that I only had one shot at this thing. And that night I said, I wonder if I'm an alcoholic. That's the incredible thing about us, is our unbelievable ability to overlook overwhelming evidence. And I said, I hope to God I am, because I had tried everything I could think of to avoid it being Alcoholics Anonymous. My father had gotten sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he and my mother were acutely embarrassed about the whole thing. Just, you know, just let's not talk about it. So we didn't talk about the fact that my father was now sober. So that night I prayed. I said, Dear God, let me vanish. I didn't want to commit suicide, because by now she was so crazy that if she came home and found a dead body, she'd have gone right over the edge, you know. So I just said, God, let me vanish. And I came to the next day, and I hadn't vanished, and I was really annoyed. And I got up and got dressed and went to work. And I was selling real estate in Hollywood at that time. And there was a woman I worked with. Her name was Suzanne. And Suzanne had 6 years of sobriety, and she was having a hell of a good time. Everybody knew she was an AA, and she was just, she was great. She was just full of life and laughing, just great. And we had to go look at some new listings. I don't know if anybody here is in real estate. We had to go look at new listings on this Wednesday morning. And I had to drive. It was my turn to drive, so I'm driving. And Suzanne's sitting right next to me, and in back of me is Mary Murphy. And Mary was about 70 years old and drank 3 drinks every night of her life. And there was a woman going through a divorce who had been drinking too much for the last couple of weeks. So they have this discussion about drinking, about situational drinking, about alcoholic drinking, about periodic drinking, about drinking and drinking and drinking. And I said, if they do not shut up, I'm going to start to scream and I'm not going to be able to stop. Because I had experienced those. I don't know if you ever did that. I had experienced those things where I was driving and thought I heard screaming, you know. And it was me. You know? Things were happening to me that we got back and it was about 11 o'clock and I said the final phrase. I said, Suzanne, I'm an alcoholic and I got 20 minutes before I go to pieces. And she heard the screaming. And she dropped everything. She canceled all her appointments and she 12-stepped me. She took me to her apartment. She sat me down at her dining room table and she had the big book and she read chapter 3, chapter 5, and the 12 traditions to me. And I thought, my God, that woman's going to read that entire book to me. And I was starting to come unglued. I was, you know, I was not in great shape and starting to twitch. And then she told me her story. Now, my story was disgusting, but hers was unbelievable. Yeah. And I thought, my God, if she can stay sober, I got a shot at it. And then she gave me something. She said, here, this will help with the jumping. And I said, what is it? And she said, never mind, just get it down. It was orange juice and Karo syrup. And I had 2 large glasses. I can taste it to this day. 2 large glasses of it, and it did help. In those days, the old-timers used to walk around in suits, and they used to have pockets full of hard candy. And they would give you half a cup of coffee because we detoxed in these rooms. And So she explained to me what Alcoholics Anonymous was. She said, do you believe in God? And I said, I suppose so. And she said, that's good enough. And so she explained to me what the program was like, what was it about, and that she was taking me to a meeting. And she drove me to my house. She made me pour out all my booze. She made me get a huge cardboard box and put all my prescription drugs in it. I said, but you don't understand. You know, it's the alcohol. It's the drinking. It's the drinking that's the problem. I have some psychological problems, you know. I'm high strung. And she said, listen, honey, in Southern California, when we describe sobriety, we talk about clean and sober. And I said, what the hell does that mean? She said, that means we don't drink any alcohol or ingest any self-administered mind-altering chemicals that affect us from the neck up. So she dumped all my prescription drugs on me. And I was so crazy and so scared. I mean, I was scared. I was terrified. I didn't know what you were going to do with me. And then I let her do it. So I've been stark staring sober since that moment. And she took me to my first meeting. It was exactly like I was afraid it was going to be. It was in a church basement. It had gray walls and a low ceiling. It was filled with smoke. And all the people I never would have drank with were there. And it was a rather warm day in April, and I looked pretty much like this. I had on a $250 sports jacket. This was 1974. I had a $250 sports jacket on from Saks Fifth Avenue. French gabardine slacks, Italian loafers, and a designer tie. I had several national commercials running on television. I was always cast as a nice young man next door. I had done several modeling jobs for some high-end clothing. I looked fabulous at my first AA meeting. I was a knockout. And I walked in and everybody knew I was a drunk, and I couldn't figure that out. There were a couple of things that were going on that night that I wasn't aware of. One of them was I had newcomer eyes. Now, the only place you see that, other than on newcomers in AA, is on a dog loose in a freeway. I was terrified and horrified. And I've been drinking a lot of straight vodka for a month, and I had on a lot of lemon lime cologne, and I smelled like a gimlet. And it was like being dropped into a shark tank. I've never seen so many teeth coming at me in my life. Just, hi! And you got real close. Real close. You were touchy. And then you'd get in my face and you'd say weird stuff. Keep coming back. One day at a time, think. First things first. It was like being stoned to death with fridge magnets. Unbelievable. But a peculiar thing happened that night that has happened every night that I've attended an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting right up until tonight. In that room, I felt understood and accepted. It was the first time I had ever felt that way in my life. For some reason, all my life, I had felt like an outlaw, an unwelcome guest, an alien, a stranger, an immigrant, someone who did not quite belong. But I felt safe in that room. And you started to say the phrases that saved my life and continue to save everyone's life who comes into these rooms. When I told you what was wrong with me, you didn't say, this is what you should do. You said, I know how you feel. And as soon as somebody says that to me, it dampens down the anxiety enough for me to listen, because I have a hearing problem. And then you didn't say, this is what you should do about your life. You said, this is what I've done about mine. Take what you can use. So if you're new here and wondering what the old guy in the pink tie has got to say to you, listen with your heart. It's critical. I'm forcing myself to do it now as I'm getting back into my meetings again. You know, and the young ones are not doing it the way that we did it. We used to walk 50 miles through the snow to go to Maine. I'm forcing myself to listen with my heart. I'm forcing to do what I did when I was brand new. I'm forcing myself to listen to the things that are the same, not the differences. I am not going to allow myself to push myself out the door by listening to the differences. I am listening to the similarities, and it's hard sometimes, especially when I don't know what they're talking about, some of them. So anyway, I sat next to my sponsor the first night that I was sober, and he started shoving down the 12 steps down my throat. I didn't get to go to meetings and study them or go to groups and talk about them or anything. I just had to take them. And the first three were fairly easy for me. I have a talent for surrender. Anybody with a louder voice or was bigger than me, I'd surrender. No problem. I mean, the first one was, you know, I was powerless over alcohol. My life had become unmanageable. That was clear. My life was dribbling down my sleeve, for Christ's sake. I mean, with this wonderful picture of me in the $250 sports jacket and the commercials running, the only problem with that picture at the first meeting was I still had fingerprint ink on. I mean, you know, what's wrong with this picture? Yeah. And what I had accepted that first day was that I could not drink. I wanted to, but I could not drink. And I also understood at a very deep level that my life was over, but I was not going to die. And I never want to feel like that again as long as I live, and I never have. So the first step was fairly easy for me. The second step was, came to believe that a power greater than myself would restore me to sanity. Now, ooh, it's getting close to that G word, you know, but luckily, I had this guy, this sponsor. If you are new, get a sponsor. Get a sponsor. This thing makes no sense at all. None whatsoever. It was like you were speaking Swahili to me. I had no idea what I could not translate it. And luckily I had this guy sitting next to me saying, this is what they mean to you. You know, I'd walk into a meeting and say, Jack would say, he said, keep coming back. He said, don't drink between meetings. It was like that for me. I would go to a meeting and hear a speaker, and I would come home, and my Al-Anon would say, what did the speaker say? I go, my chips were a little scattered when I got here. And I was detoxing. I was coming, you know, I went to my first meeting on Wednesday night and went back to work at 9 o'clock on Thursday morning. I mean, we did that. In those meetings, there were guys having grand mal seizures in the aisle. You know, somebody like me would be up talking, and somebody down there would go, boom, you know. And a bunch of guys would get up, somebody would stick a wallet in his mouth, somebody would call an ambulance, the guy would keep on talking, the ambulance guys would come in, put up the gurney, put him on, take him out, and the whole meeting just went right on, you know? And the wonderful thing about that was, I mean, it was terrifying to look at. I found out from the guys that it happened to that it doesn't hurt at all. But anyway, my sponsor would jab me in the ribs and say, keep drinking, that'll happen to you. So I want to thank each and every guy who ever had a grand mal seizure, and in one of my AA meetings, you kept me sober another day. I mean, it was just, I didn't want to do that. I mean, I just didn't want to do that. So anyway, I you know, they're giving me half a cup of coffee because I'm lethal, you know. And I was about 4 days sober, and I was well-dressed, so they asked me to read chapter 5, and I got up and read it and sat down, and the chairman said that was the first time that she had ever heard it read in one breath. So that was my condition. Restore me to sanity. I was going to meetings in Hollywood, California. I mean, there were some seriously crazy people in AA. And I had never done the rubber rooms and paper slippers and no doorknobs on this side. You know, I'm a nice upper middle class drunk. We go to therapists and talk about stress. And they give us meds. But they had assigned me a new best friend. My new best friend was Rich. That's what his name was, Richard. And Richard had 6 months of sobriety, which meant that he could say anything he wanted to me. But if I said anything to him, he said, don't take my inventory. So it was a wonderful relationship. This is fabulous. And the reason we were new best friends was I had a car. He couldn't drive. He couldn't talk. And I couldn't shut up. So we would drive to meetings. And Rich would sit in the passenger seat like, it was heaven. So anyway, we were going to this spiffy Friday night meeting in L.A. called Rodeo Drive, and it's in Beverly Hills. It was a very nice meeting. So it was the 70s, and we had big hair in the 70s. And Rich had thinning hair, which was difficult for him. And so I was over to ready to pick him up, and he was getting his hair done, which involved torturing it forward and then kind of spraying it and then bending it back over and to get that kind of Peter Lawford hair helmet look, you know? So while he was doing that, he had a big medical dictionary, and I started looking through it, and I decided to look up insanity. Just your average day, look up insanity. And there was a huge medical definition of it, and out of the middle of it popped a phrase, quote, a seeming inability to learn from one's mistakes. Let me run that by you one more time. A seeming inability to learn from one's mistakes. I took the second step right there, right then. That was me. I kept slamming into the same brick wall, and the only thing that I was concentrating on was getting out of the situation. I never, ever took the time to examine how I got into the situation. I lived a completely unexamined life. It was based on survival. My mantra was, a moving target is harder to hit. So I took the second step. I mean, I clearly qualified. And a power greater than me consisted of somebody who had 20 minutes more sobriety than me. The big book was a power greater than me. A meeting was a power. Everything was a power greater than me. But they don't let you off the hook that easy in this thing. By the way, I want you to know something. If you're new about this thing, you don't have to take these steps. These are not commandments. These are simply reporting on what we've done. That's the whole marvelous thing about it. You know, Alan McGinnis talks about if the Ten Commandments was set up the way the steps were, we'd be a lot better off. You know, if it was, I did honor my mother and father. I have not borne false witness against my neighbor. I mean, that would be great, wouldn't it? So this is just reporting on what we've done. You can do whatever the hell you want. There's no dogma in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's no experts in Alcoholics. There's no pope in Alcoholics Anonymous. There really isn't. There are a few guys who are kind of getting ready in case the position gets opening. But so I'm just reporting to you what I did. You can do whatever you want. Just don't drink. Just don't drink. So anyway, now we hop to the third step, and that's the, you know, oh my God, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to God. I understand God. Well, I'm Irish Catholic, you know. I mean, you know, I grew up with this old dude with a big beard, with a huge book, who is writing down not only everything I did, but everything I thought of doing. And I was a thinker. And for that, I was to be condemned to eternal flames with devils flailing my flesh off with whips. But he loved me. And I had a, and see, I got a hearing problem, so that may not be what they told me. But that's what I heard, you know? And I went 12 years to Catholic schools, you know? Taught by Christian Brothers of Ireland. Taught how to be a man by men who had given it up. So I had some deep-rooted problems with God. By the time I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous, my entire spiritual life consisted of those two alcoholic prayers. The first one is, dear God, get me out of this and I'll never do it again. And the second alcoholic prayer is, whew. But that third step isn't about that. The third step isn't about church or religion or anything. The third step is about a decision. A decision to begin to live my life based on spiritual principles. That's what the third step is about. And this is what it's like. If I decide I want a house, I don't get the key to the house. If I decide I want a house, I buy a newspaper. And I check the newspaper for one, ads for realtors, and then I find a realtor and I go look at some houses, a whole bunch of houses, and eventually I find one that I like and I make an offer, and there's a counter offer and another offer and a counter offer, and we agree on the price, and then I go to the bank and I get the loan, and then they inspect the house, and then there's insurance stuff to be done and all kinds of stuff. And months after I have made the decision to have a house, I've taken a whole lot of steps and the keys are given to me and I unlock the door to my house. That's what the third step is. And so I made that decision to turn it over to a God that I, to this day, do not understand. I got to tell you, as I stand here, I have a deep, profound love of and confidence in a God of my very own that is so personal that it's none of your business. So we went on to the fourth step. The fourth step is the definition of the problem. I'm the problem. I wrote it down. Fears, resentment, sexual problems, bingo, did it. You know, I was 3 weeks sober when my little sponsor turned on me and said, you got 3 weeks to do your fifth step. I didn't know you couldn't do it at 3 weeks sober, so I did it. And 6 weeks sober, I sat down with a guy I'd known for 6 weeks and told him everything about myself, which is not how I operated. Usually I found out enough information about you that if you crowded me, I threatened to expose you. I mean, that's. But here I was talking to somebody I didn't know very well about everything. Now, if you're new, I would encourage you, first of all, to get the sponsor to translate what this is because you have no idea what you're doing. And then take your fifth step with him. First of all, the phone calls go from 3/4 an hour to 5 minutes because you don't have to do the backstory every time you talk to him. That happens, first of all. And the second is, I have a desperate need to be known. I am the Fred Astaire of alcoholism. I am flashy and charming, and I can talk it like you wouldn't believe. And I can give you little bits of the information, enough to just get me crazy enough that a drink sounds like a good idea. But I suddenly had somebody in my life who knew all about me, everything. And almost immediately he started doing things like, you need to go over and talk to that guy over there because he's got a problem similar to yours. And I said, wait a minute, did you tell him? He said, no, he's got the guts to talk about it, you know. Go talk to him. So almost immediately I started to understand that my worst secrets were the things that were going to be my strongest assets. So I'd done the fifth step with this guy. And I got a guy in my life who knows me. Now, you know, there's a reaction that you have after that. I don't know if you had this. You know, about a week after I did my fifth step with the guy, I went, oh, man, what did I do? Ooh. So I didn't call him for like 2 or 3 days, you know. Finally he called me, he said, oh, backing out, huh? So the sixth and seventh step just seemed to be ongoing for me. Man, the defects of character and the shortcomings are just, I mean, they're just incredible. But what we did is an exercise. I learned an exercise that I do with the guys that I sponsor. Once we've done a fifth step and we do a written sixth and seventh step, and then what I do is I get them to write what the opposite of the defect of character or the shortcoming is, and get them to write what that list looks like. And then we start talking about a path to living like that. A path to living the opposite of the way we've been living before. What are some of the steps we can take? What are some of the things we can get to? And it's a fascinating exercise. The eighth step was a list of people I had harmed. Not annoyed. Harmed. Harmed. I annoyed practically everybody I knew. I was kind of the suicide bomber of alcoholism. You know, when I blew myself up, I took a lot of people with me. A lot of people got wounded hanging around me drinking, and I had a lot of amends to make to people I had done. I always kind of thought of myself as having towering emotions. You know, kind of murderous rages and suicidal depressions, and basically I did a lot of sleazy, disgusting, smarmy, embarrassing. I was embarrassed. That was the overriding emotion of my life, embarrassment. I'd just done this crappy stuff, you know. And so the ninth step was just really crappy, you know. I hated it. And my sponsor told me to drop the phrase, except when to do so would injure them or others. No use bringing it up after all these years, it'll only upset them, you know. No, I had to knock on doors and say, I need to talk to you. Now amends are not apologies. If there was an Olympic event for apologizing, I'd be a gold medal winner. I am a fabulous apologizer. If I've stole a grand from you and I come and apologize, chances are I'd walk out of there with $2,000. I mean, I'm just fantastic at apologizing. But that's not what it is about. What it is about is I have to go to you and say, look, we were involved in something together and this is what I did. And I need to, first of all, apologize for that. And make you understand that I am sincerely sorry for it. Now I also need to ask you, is there anything that I can do to repair the damage that I've done? And once we've discussed that, then I got to say to you, I also want to make a pledge to you, and you can watch me if you want. I will never do that to you or to anybody else again. That's what making amends is. It's the tough stuff of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got to tell you, practically everybody that I know who is drunk again after coming to this fellowship have gotten drunk because they will not complete their ninth step. It's amazing. When they come back, I ask them, and it gets down to the ninth step, and there's stuff that they will not do, and it's the stuff that kills you. It's the battery acid that drips on your soul, man. And I got to tell you, by the time I literally, that book is true, by the time I was halfway through my amends, I started to feel not better than or less than, but started to feel even. I started to feel that I belonged here. I stepped into something that I had no idea. I had stepped into not being a stranger. I wasn't hiding anymore. It was an amazing feeling. Now, I want to tell you, I just had a birthday April 24th, and it was a significant one for me. And two things happened to me the day before my birthday. I love this program. I'm standing in an elevator in an office building. You know, me and another guy watching the numbers, because you don't talk in an elevator. Watching the numbers. And this voice next to me says, "You're Sean, aren't you?" And I went, "Oh." I said, "Yeah." And he said, "I heard you talk one time, and you said something that changed my life. Oh, this is my floor." And he got out. So I still don't know what it was that I said to him. I love that. For a moment, I kind of blew up, and then I went, yeah. And then I went to this meeting, and this guy said something, and I made some really stupid remark. My sense of humor has changed in Alcoholics Anonymous from being vicious to being self-deprecatory. I laugh at myself more than I laugh at you. But I mean, I had a slip, and I mean, I just zinged one across the room, and it hit. Bam! Right on. You know, and the guy kind of jolted. It was a nasty crack and really funny, and everybody in the room laughed at him. It was one of those ones, you know? I'm taking my cake the next night. So I had to wait for like 20 minutes after everybody kind of got on and said, "I need to talk to you. I need to apologize to you. I apologize for that crack." He said, "I thought it was funny." I said, "It wasn't." And I said, I haven't done that in a long, long time, and I want to guarantee you that I'm not going to do it again. And he said, "Hey, all right, fine, you know." But I had to, you know, when you're sober a long time, making amends are a real drag. But the ninth step is a really great deterrent for me because I hate making amends. You know, and when you're new, you know, "I'm sorry I threw up on your Christmas tree, but I have this disease," you know. You know, but you got 10, 20 years of sobriety and say, you know, "I'm sorry I threw up in your Christmas tree. You got another thing you got to do." But and then came the 10th step, you know, and the 10th step is something that I do on a daily basis. And I have trouble with right and wrong because I'm Irish Catholic. So, you know, if I do something wrong, I kill myself worse than anybody would ever kill me, you know. So what I do on a 10 steps, I look at my day and I say, "What did I do today that I approve of, and what did I do today that I don't approve of?" And the stuff that I approve, I say thank you and let it go, and the stuff that I don't approve of, I try to rectify the next day and try to change, and that's how it works for me, and it's kept me in good stead for a while. And then comes the 11th step, which is prayer and meditation. Now, I'm a child of the 60s, and I know about meditation. You light it up, and you listen to sitar music. So Rich and I decided we were going to get really spiritual, so we went to this 11-step meeting in Hollywood. It was a midnight meeting at Fairfax and La Cienega. It was nuts. It was a candlelight meeting, and there were about 50 people in this meeting and two candles. And so what would happen is they would say, "Jane is going to read chapter 5, so Jane would kind of stumble out of the darkness and get to the candle and go... "Rarely have we seen a person fail," and I'd start to giggle. And then Rich would start to giggle. And then it was like giggling in church. I mean, it was just the worst. So we tried everything because we really wanted to be serious. So he'd sit at that end in the dark, and I couldn't see him. And I'd sit at this end. And then Joe would read chapter 5, and I'd hear him. And then I'd start to go. I mean, we tried, but we got the giggle. And of course, we got everybody giggling. You know, it was just awful. So finally, the secretary suggested that we find another meeting. I've been asked to leave an AA meeting for giggling. Yeah. We also were in danger at one point in our sobriety of being crushed to death by a bookshelf full of spiritual literature. You know, I read everything, you know. And I've tried it all. But what it's boiled down to for me now is I do a very short one. I sit in a comfortable chair. I don't lie down because that's called napping. And I sit in a comfortable chair and I concentrate on a phrase from the other big book. And the phrase is, be still and know that I am God. And what I do is I break that down word by word and concentrate on each of the words. And it's a lovely meditation for me. It gets me kind of centered. When I don't do it, you drive badly. That's I just know, you know. Oop. And then the 12th step has those three parts. You know, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, and I have had a spiritual awakening, is of the educational variety. I have never seen a burning bush. The wind didn't blow up my ass like it did with Bill Wilson. None of that. None of that. None of that. It's been slow. Been slow evolution. And carrying the message to alcoholics who still suffer is something that I do on it. Whenever I'm asked, when I got sober, you couldn't get guys into the hospital if they were drunk. And one of the first 12-step calls I had was like at 2:00 in the morning. I took this guy, he was dead drunk, to LA County Hospital, and I took him in, and he was drunk. And they said, So I took him out in the parking lot and stomped on his toe and broke it, and then took him back in. So the old timers told me to do. So they had to take him. He had a broken toe. He didn't feel it. I love being asked to do this, but I want you to understand that I know that this is the least important 12-step work this is. You know, standing here in my pink tie is the least important 12-step work there is. Because I can tell you anything I want, because I'm getting on a plane tomorrow and going back to Vancouver. You don't get to see if I'm really telling you the truth. And I must say, I talk a slightly better program than I work. I pray that it's only slight, but the most important 12-step work is one drunk talking to another. You know, standing there telling some guy your story while he's throwing up on your shoes. You know, you know, taking a guy to a detox. You know, taking him home and putting him on your couch and feeding him orange juice and Karo syrup and getting him through the night. You know, that kind of stuff. And I love doing that. I have been of service in Alcoholics Anonymous whenever they've asked me. I have gone through the general service thing right up to alternate delegate for Southern California. I've served at all kinds of levels. Like I said, I now wash the coffee urns and put away the chairs. I've always had a commitment. The first night that I was sober, the guy who became my sponsor sat next to me, said, fold up your chair, empty your ashtray, and wash out your cup. And I did that the first night I was sober, and I've been doing some variations of that ever since. And then comes the biggie, to practice these principles in all our affairs. Because I really do believe there's somebody's watching me. I had watched Suzanne, who 12-stepped me. I'd watched her for a year and a half. And I liked what she had. I liked the way she lived her life. And I knew a lot about her. And I watched, and I watched. And I knew that when I was going to crash and burn, she was the one. She was the one I was going to turn to. I knew it. I just knew it. So I don't know who's watching me. And I don't know who's watching you. There's somebody's watching you. And you're the only big book that they've ever seen. And that's the way it is for us. This thing is designed to restore us to normal life. This means we take this thing out of these rooms, out into our community, out into our homes, out into our workplaces. We take it out there, proudly sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we live like sober members of Alcoholics. If we're successfully working the program, it will be a surprise to the people in our workplace that we are alcoholic. You know? And we become very effective at 12-step work. I got to be, a couple of years ago, the president of the Chamber of Commerce in my hometown. And I was at a very nice dinner party. I've been at those nice dinner parties where somebody is sitting next to you who's drinking their fourth glass of wine. And the guy says, man, I wish I could cut back on this. And I say, oh, yeah, I know how you feel. He said, but you didn't have anything to drink. No, I didn't. Did you used to drink? Oh, yeah, I used to drink. Did you drink a lot? Oh, yeah, yeah. But you don't drink anything now? No, I don't. No. Well, how'd you do that? I said, well, I'm an alcoholic. I go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. You want to go to a meeting? Watch their jaw drop. You? So I like not looking like a drunk. I like not acting like a drunk. So where am I now? Well, let me tell you. 34 years sober now. If I'd have known I was going to be sober this long, I'd have tried to be a better example, but... I haven't got any wisdom. I thought I might, but I don't. I just got experience, man. That's all I got. And that's the only commodity in Alcoholics Anonymous that is of any value, is sober experience. Doesn't matter what my religious dogma is, my psychological take on this, or anything else. The only thing that matters is my sober experience. If you come to me and say, this is what's going on with you, and I've got the experience of working through it, I can share it with you. If I don't, I can say, you got to go talk to Fred, because Fred went through exactly that. You need to talk to him. Keep it real simple. So life, I keep waiting for a plateau. You know, I keep waiting for that moment when you have sponsored enough guys, been to enough meetings, been of service long enough, you know, done all that stuff where you can kind of sit in a lawn chair and just chill. Doesn't happen in the first 34 years. Sorry about that. I'm still sponsoring, guys. I'm still sponsored. I moved to Canada, and my sponsor, who I knew in Southern California, I've known him for my entire sobriety, moved there, and I asked him to sponsor me. I'm wearing this tonight. It's a forget-me-not. My sponsor has Alzheimer's. Yeah. And it's very hard. Yeah, it's very hard. But he's also sober, and he's got a sense of humor. I take him out for drives, and we have these circular conversations, you know. We kind of loop every 5 minutes, and, you know. So we got a lot of the same territory covered, but it's covered really well. And then he can't remember stuff, and he gets really frustrated, and I can't remember stuff either. And so I say to him, you got an excuse. You got Alzheimer's. I'm just stupid, you know. So we laugh. He's a wonderful man. His name is Milton. And Milton's African-American. I have a beautiful 26-year-old daughter. You have beautiful and intelligent children, but I have Kate. And she's now a young woman and a stunning and exciting, bright and funny, wonderful young woman who has grown up in this fellowship. And she calls Milton her grandfather. So when when people, you know, are talking about their grandparents and she's talking about her grandparents, eventually they realize, you know, they go, wait a minute, your grandfather's black? She says, oh, yeah. And just goes on with her, you know. She's a stunning redhead. So anyway, Milton used to be in rock and roll. We were talking about this. I'll tell this story because you know, you look for ways to thank the man who's helped sustain and save your life. He's my go-to guy. I go to him with my plans. I don't go to him with my histories. I go to him with my plans. This is what I'm thinking about doing. I don't go to him with, this is what I've done, help me out of it. It keeps it real simple. And he was going to Cleveland, Ohio, and he was going to go to the Rock and Roll Museum because he had been in a group called Billy Ward and the Dominoes. And in 1949, they had a hit song called 60 Minute Man. And he was going to go look at it at the Rock and Roll Museum and get some T-shirts for his kids. And I emailed them and said, you might want to talk to this guy. And within 3 hours, they got back to me and said, yes. So anyway, it was going to be a surprise. And then I couldn't do that because surprises are always hostile. So I said, this is what I've done. And you've got an appointment at 10 o'clock in the morning. He said, you shouldn't have done that. He was really mad. I just wanted to go in there. And I said, they know you're coming. Be nice. So they met him and they treated him like royalty. They took him on a tour. They got him all the stuff at the shop for his kids. They gave him a leather jacket. I mean, they just treated him like a prince. And the executive director said, "Come up to the office." And they were sitting talking. He said, "I need to get something clarified." He said, "When your group came to Cleveland in 1949, you met with Alan Freed, who was the great disc jockey, who you know was the great rock and roll disc jockey." And Milton said, "Yes." And he said, "I understand you were talking about 60 Minute Man." And Alan Freed said, "This is a song. This is something we've never heard before. It's not race music, and it's not rhythm and blues, but it's another form. It's something different." And Milton said, "Yeah, that's how the conversation went." And he said, "From what I understand, Billy Ward at one point in the discussion said, well, you know, there's a lyric in the song that says, we'll rock you, we'll roll you, we'll love you all night." And Alan Freed said, "Well, why don't we call it rock and roll?" So my sponsor was on the first rock and roll record. He was sitting in the room when they named it, you know. And so he came back. He came back to Vancouver, and it had been a terrific, terrific experience for him. And it was shortly thereafter that he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. So before the darkness started to descend, there was a huge burst of light, and a lot of people wanted to talk to him, and he started talking about it for the first time in a long, long time. And you know, you always look for a way to give that person who's given you the gift of sobriety something back, and I got the chance, and it was wonderful. It was wonderful. A couple of years ago, me and the Al-Anon looked at each other and said, we don't need to do this anymore, do we? And I said, no, we don't. So we decided not to wait until the children were dead. And so about a year or so ago, the divorce was final. And so it's a big transition for me. You know, now I'm suddenly a newcomer's worst nightmare. I'm... I'm old, sober, and alone. Yeah. Oh, I want what he's got. Yeah. Huge transition for me. We had been together 37 years, and did it with an incredible amount of dignity and compassion for each other, and a lot of phone calls to our sponsors, and we arbitrated a settlement, and there were no lawyers involved, and it was rather well done. Do I wish her every good thing in her life? Absolutely. Do we have lunch often? No. Yeah. Um, So here I am, you know. I'm old, you know. And so my sponsor, you know, my sponsor's got Alzheimer's. And, you know, so what happens sometimes is they get stuck on an idea. You know, they won't let go, you know. So he got into this thing about dating. You got a date. I said, date? Date? Yeah. He said, you got to get out there and date. I said, the last date I had was in 1969. It was Chappaquiddick, the moonwalk, and my last date. I mean, that was it. I have no idea. I mean, my idea of dating in 1969 was finding somebody who would drink insanely until 5 o'clock in the morning and then turn into a pizza. You know? The kind of dating I did was you come to, you know, and you're... You're lying next to it. And you don't know who it is. Or what it is. Or what you've done with it. Or what you promised it. Whether you're your place or its place, you know? And you got to get up and get out of there and find your clothes without waking it up, you know? And then one day you come to and it's awake. And it's looking at you. And you look into its eyes. And you realize you've become its it. So that's my dating experience. That's what I got to offer. So he said, you got to do it. So I was doing this project, and there was this divorced lady, had a grown daughter, and we were working together, and so we went to lunch to discuss some business, and we did, and we talked about our daughters and you know, got the business stuff done, and we split the bill, and she went to her car, I went to my car, and I drove, and I said, ah, good, this is it. So I called Milton, I said, I did it, you know, I said, good. So 3 o'clock in the morning, the next morning, the phone rang. It's her. She's dead drunk, and she wants to know if I'm interested in her. So I said, that's it. That's it. I'm not doing this anymore. I'm going to become an old fart in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to become one of those old jerks in Alcoholics Anonymous who sits back out there and when somebody talks about Oprah from the podium, yells, outside issue! You remember those guys? Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to become one of those old farts. I spilled more on my tie than you drank. You know, those jerks. I'm going to become one of those guys. This is one of those old farts. You don't know how to stay sober for Christ's sake. You know, I'm working on that. So after I told him my dating thing, he thought maybe it was probably a good idea that I do become an old fart. Because dating these days is real different. For, you know, my God. I mean, you got to have medical records. And you know? Legal agreements and, you know, who's got the rights to the sex video, you know? And I mean, it's complicated, you know? You know, may I hold your hand? You got to ask permission now. I mean, you know, it's, you know. And let's face it, I mean, for God's sake, I'm going to be 66 years old in August. You know, I only tell you that because I don't look it. And let's face it, I mean, it's been a long time since there's been a party in my pants. It's like Tierra del Fuego. It's down there, but who cares? You know, if it got up close and personal with one of these ladies, I mean, I'm in trouble. I don't know about you, yeah. you know, I thought about those little blue pills, but, you know, I haven't taken any self-ingested mind-altering chemicals that affect me from the neck up for 34 years. I don't know about self-ingested mind-altering chemicals that affect you from the belt down, you know. I'm an alcoholic, you know. If one of those things worked, you know, woohoo, yeah. Yeah. Whoa. Let's try five. Yeah. If I started on those within a week, they'd find me dead in a gutter underneath my own tent. You look so happy. Would have to be an open casket. They couldn't get the... You know. That triangle on the circle floral display looks so nice. I wonder what they attached it to. Yeah. Did you just hear that? Did you just hear that? I'm talking about stuff that I drank about when I was 14 years old. And we were all laughing about it. In these rooms, we laugh at the bad stuff and we cry at the good stuff. It's called Alcoholics Anonymous. I just told you about five or six things that are going on in my life. Divorced, retired, not much money. You know. But I found a solution. Baking. Oh, yeah. Baking. I found me a cake recipe. Mexican chocolate cake and homemade creme fraiche. Oh, yeah. When you show up at a small dinner party with a homemade chocolate cake and a homemade creme fraiche, it's like shooting fish in a barrel, man. I've returned to my first love, which is the theater, which I'd done in New York for years. I've just, this season, produced a play I just closed and a couple of Ibsen plays. I'm having a wonderful, wonderful time. I have a full, enriched life. I was faced with that kind of loneliness that people my age collapse under. You know, I went to see my doctor. He said, "You're clinically depressed." And I said, yeah, of course I am. I'm depressed because I feel bad. A lot of bad shit has happened to me. You know? And it's going to get better and I won't be depressed, so I don't need your meds, thank you very much. You know, let's give me a vitamin B12 shot and let me out of here. And so I'm working through the bad stuff in my life, you know? I'm stumbling toward, you know, whatever. I'm you know, if you don't want to be lonely, build a community. I got a community, you know? And have the balls to tell somebody you're lonely, you know? Can I come to, you know, there's a bunch of guys on Thursday night who go to the movies after the meeting. I said, "Can I come?" And they said, "Well, sure. We never thought of asking you, you know?" I said, "Well, think about it, because I need to go." Yeah? So I sponsor my guys, and I go to my meetings, and I take my sponsor for rides, and I talk to them, and I keep doing it, and I'm building my community outside of outside of AA. I teach drama. I am actively involved in the theater world. I work with a theater company that is for physically and mentally challenged actors. And I mean, what they're teaching me are lessons in courage every time that I work with them. I've got a fabulous, fabulous life. It is nothing like I planned it. It is nothing like I planned it, and it is incredible. It is extraordinary. I love my life. And I love my life because I allow myself to love you. And I allow you to love me back. It's absolutely wonderful. I always consider when I'm asked to be at one of these things that this is basically a report to my teachers. Because when I've had the courage to tell you what's going on with me, you've said, I know how you feel. And then you've always said, this is what I've done, take what you can use. And you've taught me everything essential and brilliant and loving and kind and glorious about my life. The little mean, sniggly, embarrassing, nasty-minded stuff is what I decided I didn't need to learn. So I keep coming back. I keep coming back to tell you how I'm doing. And you get to listen. And if you got something to judge me on, be kind. I realize I got a long, long way to go. But because of you, I have come very, very far. If you want to know how this program works, I'll tell you. It's real simple. I learned it from these conferences. I learned it because I got to travel in different parts of the country. And in the southern part of the United States, when people are asked to share at these podiums, they get up and give you the formula. They say something like this. Listen hard, newcomers. This is the whole package. My name is Sean Allen. And by the grace of a loving God, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 steps, the 12 traditions, service in Alcoholics Anonymous, a strong sponsor, sponsoring other people, and being of service, it has not been necessary for me to have a drink of alcohol nor to ingest any self-administered mind-altering chemicals that affect me from the neck up since April 24th, 1974. And for that, I am very, very grateful. God bless you.